Oop. Do I get them all? So, what equations are we going to use? That's the one equation we're not going to use, right? Because we're out, we're not using forces currently. We're using energies whenever we can. So on this list, what are the important equations?
All of them.
All of them? No. I think only three of them. Louder?
Mg.
Well, I don't know about Mg.
Mg.
I like, say again?
Mg.
Yeah, that's what she said. I'm not going for Mg. I didn't hear the H. I like the H. Right. We want the energy of gravity. What else do we want? We want the energy of spring. And finally, what's the other equation that's relevant? Well, so we could write down kinetic energy as an intermediate step, but at the beginning and the end, the kinetic energy is zero. So we're not, I think, literally going to use it. I think the other one is clear enough that no one's even talking about it. We're going to use conservation of energy. Right? So there are no frictional forces here. So we don't have to worry about the work done by the non-conservative forces. It's just a matter of the initial energy equals the final energy. So what's the initial potential energy in the spring? Zero. What's the final potential energy in the spring? Well, it depends on how much it stretches, right? The more stretched, the more potential energy there is in the spring. What's the initial gravitational potential energy? So it's kind of a matter of what's the definition of H, right? And you can choose it any way you want. I think, at least for me, the reasonable way of choosing it is at its initial spot. It's not the only possibility, but if I do that, then the total initial energy is zero kinetic energy, zero energy in the spring, and zero gravitational potential energy. In the final state, the spring has been stretched, and this thing has gone down. If the spring has stretched by x, then that thing has gone down by x. And in the final situation, we've got zero kinetic energy. We've got spring energy that is 1/2 kx squared. And for the gravitational potential energy, we've got mgh. But now h is minus x, right? It's gone down however much the spring is stretched. And the initial energy has to equal the final energy. So we've got then that 0 has to be 1/2 k x squared minus mgx. It's a quadratic equation. We could solve it using the quadratic equation. But it should be clear that there's one immediate solution, namely if the final case is the same as the initial case, if x is equal to 0. And that is to say we can factor this. Like that. Or you can use the quadratic equation. Either of them work. We need to find the root of this quadratic equation. One root is that x is equal to 0. The other possibility is that this is equal to 0, which means that 1/2 kx wants to equal mg. So x wants to equal 2 mg divided by k. So that's 2 times 2 times 9.8 divided by 60. And what I got was 0.65. Notice that the final position is just going to drop that 2, right? Because that's going to be force equality. Questions? A lot of unhappy faces.
Yeah, this is before fall break.
Just what you needed before you went home for a long weekend. A little bit louder. So joules are Newton meters, Newton's times meters.
Yeah. Oh, Newton meter, not Newton per meter.
Correct, Newton times meters. If we want to check units, which is, I guess, always smart to do, what we had was kilograms times the acceleration of gravity divided by K, which was Newton's per meter. And this is a Newton, and that's a Newton. So we are getting meters out. More questions? Okay, so in this chapter, we're not using this line very much. We're mostly using this line down here. We're dealing with energies and works. And they're kind of equivalent ways of working the same problems. You may have noticed that lots of the problems we could solve by the chapter 2 methods even.
Would there be a way to solve with just the force equations for this problem?
So I think probably the reason the book talks about springs is they make it not possible to solve using the methods we have so far. So the methods we have so far have to do with constant forces and constant accelerations. And the spring force isn't constant, and so it screws up the ability to use the chapter 2 methods. So heretofore, the homework that was assigned in the last class period where we just had gravity, you could work all of those problems with chapter 2 methods if you really wanted to. But once we have springs and we have forces that aren't constant, then we've got really pretty much have to use energy methods. And of course, this is the usual case, right? Constant forces are at the beginning of the book because they're the simplest possible cases. In the real world, all the forces depend on position.
Are you going to drop any quiz scores?
I'm not. It's all good data.
Was it essential that we had the energy initial equal to the energy final on there?
So that's a tough question to answer. So I do care about the method. So I need to be able, if I just saw 65 centimeters for sure, if I just saw that equation, you're not going to get a lot of points. But if I can see how this equation was derived, then I'll be happier. So in answer to your question, I don't think you literally have to have this, but you have to have something that's kind of similar to this that shows me that you're using conservation of energy. More questions? So in the chapter that we just finished, we spent a lot of time talking about conservation of energy, one of the three great conservation laws that we're going to be talking about in this class. The one that's in the next chapter is conservation of momentum. And the idea of conservation of momentum is, I think, pretty obvious. It's what makes this balloon work. Right? So we see that something is pushing that balloon forward. All it's doing is ejecting part of its mass, like a rocket, and as a result, the balloon is going forward. So that's what we're trying to understand, how exactly that works. And the starting point for this, kind of the starting point for energy conservation, was defining what work and kinetic energy were. So our starting point here is going to be defining what momentum is. And momentum is, again, something that's pretty simple. It's just mass times velocity. Now, technically speaking, velocity has a direction, so momentum has a direction. So the momentum is really the mass times the velocity. For reasons I don't understand, P is the symbol that everyone uses for momentum. I don't see the P in momentum. Now, to say that momentum is constant seems not particularly clear, right? So this thing currently has zero momentum, and while it fell, it picked up momentum. Momentum did not at all seem to be held constant. So for conservation of energy, the condition that was required for literally conservation of energy was that the work done by the non-conservative forces was zero. So there's going to be a condition for conservation of momentum, and it's going to be that there are no external forces. Right, so obviously there's an external force of gravity on this falling glob, and it's what's changing the momentum of this glob. If I look at a situation where there are strong forces between two objects, right, so I'm going to have a collision between these two guys. Right, so this guy is going to have some momentum, and it's going to transfer its momentum to the other guy. And there are lots of sort of collisions that we can have. We can have particularly what's called an inelastic collision, where the two things stick together afterwards. Okay? But still, there was some momentum in the initial situation and some momentum in the final situation. Strong forces between the objects in the system, but no external forces, right? I had tried to eliminate external forces by doing it on this frictionless surface. Okay, so lots of conservation of momentum problems are going to involve collisions where we have strong internal forces between the objects, but no external forces. Cases where the objects stick together that's called a totally inelastic collision. There's another type of collision we're going to be particularly interested in, an extreme case, and that's where energy is conserved, where as much energy at the beginning of the situation as there was at the end of the situation. And that's called an elastic collision. Realistic collisions are usually a bit of both. There's usually some non-conservation of energy that's involved in any collision. So when the bat hits the baseball is going to be deformed, and there's going to be some energy loss as a result of that process. We can try and simulate elastic collisions by having these nice bumpers where we have as little amount of energy loss as possible. Okay, so along with the idea of conservation of momentum is we're going to have something that's kind of like work that deals with how the momentum is going to change if there are external forces. So remember that work was the area under force versus position. What we're going to talk about next is impulse. And impulse is the area under force versus time. So on a typical, say, a baseball bat hitting a ball, for a very short period of time, there are lots of forces. And the area under this, that's what we mean by the impulse. And kind of like this theorem here, we can show that the impulse is equal to the change in the momentum. Okay, so that's all we need to get going, a concept of change in momentum, and that the impulse is going to give us that change in momentum. So before we go on to kind of homework problems, let's take a look at some iQuiz problems that are work and energy related. Well, that's a hard one. Let's start with an easier one. So here we have three different forces And all of those forces are equal in magnitude but differ in direction. And the block is going to move to the right by 3 meters. Rank the work done by each force. Okay, so here's kind of the situation. We got these three forces, and we're trying to, they all have the same magnitude. This thing is going to move this way 3 meters. What's the work done by those forces? See lots of right answers, but I see a good number of wrong answers too. So just in terms of the sign, S-I-G-N, how much work is F1 going to do? Positive, negative, or zero? Yeah, because it's pushing in the direction it's going. How about F2?
Zero.
Mm-hmm. And how about F3? So negative is the smallest, so we're looking for where W3 is the smallest, and we got A. Okay, so here's a bunch of questions we can ask about this situation that's kind of been the topic of homework problems. So we have this mass that is released from some point A, and at point B it makes contact with this previously uncompressed spring, and it's going to compress the spring all the way down to C before it starts to bounce around. So these are locations, the original location where the spring is uncompressed, where we get the maximum compression, and point D is none of the above. So where is the kinetic energy zero in this system? So I think this has to be a two-handed answer. So it's at rest at A and C, right? So that's where the kinetic energy is zero. Where is the gravitational potential energy zero? So I see lots of answers, and in some sense that's a fair, because it depends on where we choose the height. But if we choose the height to be zero where the problem says it's zero, where is the potential energy zero? Yeah, when it's at B. So until somebody tells you where height is zero is, gravitational potential energy could be anything. Where is the spring potential energy zero? Yeah, I think it's a two-handed answer. So in C, it's compressed, right? So there's certainly going to be spring potential energy in case C. But in the other two, it's not compressed. Where is the kinetic energy a maximum? I see a few right answers. I see lots of B's, which are not right answers. So when we maximize something, we're usually setting something equal to zero. So as long as it's falling, it's going faster and faster and faster, right? until the spring force starts to counter gravity and it starts to deaccelerate. So at B, it's still accelerating, right? It's still subject to the force of gravity. So we have to wait a little bit before the spring force produces as much upward force as gravity is putting downward force before we actually slow this thing down. Right? So D, right? None of the above. Where is the gravitational potential energy a maximum? So even if we don't know where the height is, no matter what the highest height, no matter what you choose is height equals zero, the highest height is at A, so that has to be the maximum gravitational potential energy. Where is the spring potential energy a maximum? Yeah, C. Okay, so those went good by the end. Well, we also got these sort of pictures too. So where is the force zero? So this is a graph of potential energy versus position. Where is the force zero? One of those two. This is not a two-handed answer.
What was the question?
So where's the force zero? So we have a graph of potential energy versus position. Where is the force zero? I guess it is a two-handed. Looked more carefully at it. So you remember that the force is minus the slope, so we're looking for the places where the slope is zero. Think about a skier, right? So a skier could sit there at the bottom of the valley and not be pushed one way or the other, and it could teeter right on the top of this mountain and balance and not be pushed anyplace. So the force is going to be zero at B and D. Where is the force positive? Which is the force positive? We're on number two. So the force is minus the slope, right? And if you think about a skier, at A, he would be pushed forward, right? At C, he would be pushed backwards. So the only place where the force is in the forward direction is at A, among these choices. Well, we've done force zero. Yeah, I think we're probably more or less done with that guy. Okay, so let's take a look at conservation of momentum sort of problems from the next chapter. So here's the lineup, starting with number 8. So here's a graph of force versus time. We have time in milliseconds. We have these forces that are basically 10,000 newtons or so. We're supposed to figure out what the impulse is and what the average force is. It's a little bit cut off. So the impulse is, of course, the area under that curve. And it's a triangle, so it's going to be half the base times the height. The base runs from 1 to 2.5, so it's 1.5 milliseconds. Milliseconds is, of course, thousandth of a second, and the height of that graph is 20,000 newtons. So of course the impulse is 1/2 the base times the height. And you can see those thousand and thousands cancel out, and what we end up with is 15 newton seconds. Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's not exactly 20, it's 18. So that I might as well recalculate. Yeah, 13.5. So the question you should be asking yourself is, what famous dead physicist is a Newton second? None yet. Yeah, we're still waiting for that guy to die. So it's just a Newton second. What's the average force? So part of that is, what do we mean by the average force, right? So I could certainly take the 18,000 and divide it by 2 and call that the average force. What we mean by the average force, though, more generally, is we're going to take the average force, well, we're going to take the impulse and multiply it by the, divide it by the time that it's been present. So this is what we mean by the average force. And it's going to turn out to be 9 for the simple case of a triangle. So we have the 13.5 Newton seconds, and we divide that by the 1.5 seconds. And we're going to get an average force that's in Newtons. And we get the 9 times 10 to the third Newtons. Oops, milliseconds, right? Milliseconds. Okay, so it's kind of like work. It's the area under force versus time, this case, as opposed to force versus position. And the value of the impulse gives us the change in momentum. Okay, so here we have a tennis player who's going to receive this ball that's going forward, going towards him at 50 meters a second, and he's going to return it so that it's going backwards at 40 meters a second. And we're supposed to figure out what the impulse was, and we're told what the ball is. So of course we can figure out what the impulse is from the change in momentum. So it's going to be mass times the final velocity minus mass times the initial velocity. Initially, the ball is going this way at 50 meters a second. Finally, it's going backwards at 40 meters a second. So we call this the positive direction. What we have then is the mass, which is 0.06. The final velocity of plus 40 minus the initial velocity of minus 50. So we've got 0.06 times 90. So this is meters per second, and this is kilograms. So we've got 54 kilograms meters per second, which, if you think about it, is exactly the same thing as a Newton second. Okay, so here we have kind of the rocket or the balloon sort of analogy. We have this fisherman that's sitting in this boat, and he's going to throw this object away. And you know that as hard as he pushes on that object, the object is going to push back. So as a result, we're expecting him to be going that away. And we can figure out what that speed is by using conservation of momentum. There are big forces between the two objects, right? He's pushing on the package, and the package is pushing back. But there aren't any external forces. So we're expecting that momentum is going to be conserved in this situation. So the fisherman and the boat are always staying together, and they have a total weight of 200 kilograms. The package has a weight of 15 kilograms, and it's being thrown at a speed of 4 meters per second. In the initial state, everything's at rest. So the initial momentum is zero. The final momentum consists of this thing going at 4.5 meters a second in, let's call it, the positive direction, and everything else going backwards at a velocity we're trying to calculate. Okay, so initial momentum is zero because everything started at rest. Final momentum, we know in part, namely the forward moving package. So it's going, it weighs 15 kilograms, and it's going at 4.5 meters per second. The boat has a total boat and fishermen have a total mass of 200 kilograms, and they're going at an unknown velocity, which I'm going to call V. And they all have to add up to zero. So we can, of course, just rearrange this. We can bring this term to the other side of the equation. And finally, the velocity is going to be the mass ratio times the 4.5. And it's negative, of course, because it's going backwards. So I get minus 0.338 meters per second. Well, there are lots of problems like this in the book, and I'm not super fond of them because it's pretty rare that you know the velocity of something relative to the water, as it were, in this case. So if you think about a little spring-loaded dart gun, for example, doesn't matter whether that gun is moving inside of a jet that's going 600 miles an hour or whether it's being held in your hand. The relative velocity, the velocity of that dart compared to the gun, is a constant. So it's kind of rare that we actually know the velocity of this thing relative to the rest situation. It's more common that we know the relative velocity, how fast something is ejected. That's certainly the case for a rocket engine, where you know the exhaust velocity, but you may not happen to know how fast the rocket itself is going currently. So if the rocket is going forward fast, for example, the exhaust also may be going forward, right? Because the exhaust velocity isn't enough to get rid of all of it. So it's pretty common to actually know not the final velocity, but the relative velocity, which is to say the difference in velocity between the two things. So in this case here, we've got, initially, we have the boat and the terminator who are all going at 4 meters a second. And we have Abraxas who is going to jump on at 10 meters a second, and we're supposed to figure out what the velocity is. And then we're going to have the terminator jump off with a relative velocity of 15 meters a second, and we're supposed to figure out what the velocity is of Abraxas and the canoe. Okay, so I'd call this a more realistic conservation of momentum problem. Okay, so for the first part of this problem, we have a system that is going at 4 meters a second that consists of the terminator and the canoe. So if we take the terminator and add it to the canoe, this thing weighs 100 kilograms. And we have Abraxas, who's about to join the system at 10 meters a second. And Abraxas weighs 100 kilograms all by himself. So we could call this an inelastic collision if we wanted to, because they're both going to end up at relative rest on the canoe. They're going to stick together, as it were. So in the initial state, the initial momentum consists of Abraxas, 100 kilograms, going 10 meters a second, and the terminator and the canoe, also 100 kilograms, going at 4 meters a second. In the final state, we have everybody together in the canoe, 200 kilograms, at some unknown final velocity, V. So we can solve for that final velocity by just adding things up, right? So we have 100 times 10 plus 100 times 4, all divided by 200. And the final velocity is seven meters a second. Okay, so let's write down this initial momentum, right? So it's 1,000 plus 400. And now we're going to have a situation where the relative velocity of the situation involving Abraxas and the canoe and the Terminator as a separate object, it still has to have the same amount of momentum. Okay, so Abraxas plus the canoe, that's 120 kilograms. It's going to be moving at some unknown speed. Can I get away with using the same symbol even though we're now in a new situation? Maybe not. Call it VA. And we have the Terminator, who is going to be, who weighs 80 kilograms, if I recall correctly, has a relative velocity, that is to say he's going 15 meters a second more than Abraxas and the canoe are going. Okay, so relative velocity means that the difference in velocity between those two is some given amount, in this case 15 meters a second. So I hope it's clear that when the Terminator pushes off, he's pushing himself forward, he's pushing the boat backwards. So we're expecting the boat to end up moving slower than 7 meters a second, and for the Terminator to be moving faster than 15 meters a than 7 meters a second. So what we've got here, if we combine terms, we have 200 times the final velocity of Abraxas in the canoe plus 80 times 15. So rearranging things, what we have is the original momentum less this 80 times 15. You might be tempted to call that the momentum of the Terminator, but it's not, right? The momentum of the Terminator is these things together. That all has to equal 200 times the velocity of the combined system. So we can, of course, divide by the 200 kilograms to get the final velocity of Abraxas by himself, by Abraxas and the canoe by himself. And I get 1 meter a second. So Abraxas and the canoe are still moving forward, but a lot slower. The Terminator is going to be going 15 meters a second, or excuse me, 16 meters a second in the positive direction. Okay, so for relative velocity problems, you have to express the velocities in terms of that relative amount. So here we have a bullet that was initially going at a speed v that goes, penetrates and goes all the way through this mass, capital M, and it emerges with half its velocity. That is to say, it's been slowed down. In the process, it's transferred a lot of its momentum to capital M. And what we're going to happen is capital M is going to have just enough energy to reach the exact top of this pendulum. Okay, so here we have a problem with no numbers, right? It's all letters. So we're looking for a formula that gives us the minimum velocity that's required for this situation to happen. So under these circumstances, during the collision, we have momentum conservation. For this swing up, we've got energy conservation. So we've got a combination of the two most recent chapters. Okay, so let's... see what these two pieces are. So in the first case, we have momentum conservation. So the initial momentum of the bullet is its mass times its speed. In the final situation, the bullet is just going to be moving at half its velocity, and all of the missing momentum, let me call it U, has to be in the big capital M blob. Okay, so all of the initial momentum is now distributed between capital M and lowercase m. And if we rearrange this equation, bring this term over to the other side, we're going to get lowercase m divided by capital M, v over 2 is equal to the final velocity, the velocity just post-collision of capital M. So then we have the part where we have energy conservation. Okay, during this collision, there are huge frictional forces that are present, right? So no surprise that energy isn't being conserved during that collision. But during this swing up, all of the forces are conservative, so we expect to have energy conservation. So energy conservation, we've got gravitational potential energy, we've got some kinetic energy. If we're talking gravitational potential energy, we have to define where zero height is. And we might as well define zero height to be where the thing is right here at the start. If we do that, then the final height is going to be 2L, right? Because L is the radius of that circle and we're a diameter up. So the initial energy, it's all kinetic energy. 1 half capital M times the speed, this post-collision speed squared. And the way I've defined my heights, no gravitational potential energy. In the final situation, this thing is just barely going to reach the top, so there's no kinetic energy, but there's gravitational potential energy, that is capital M times G times 2L, right? Because it went up two radiuses. Okay, so initial energy has to equal final energy. Let's rearrange this a little bit before we plug and chug. So we have that 1 half m velocity squared has to equal mg times 2l. So notice that the value of capital M doesn't matter for this second part. For the collision, the value of capital M matters a whole lot, right? If you shoot into a semi-truck, the semi-truck isn't going to have a huge velocity afterwards, whereas if you shoot into a young baby, it's going to have a much larger velocity. Okay, so a baby ant or a baby fly. Okay, so if we plug in this value for the post-collision velocity, we've got 1 half lowercase m, capital M, the bullet speed divided by 2, all of that squared has to equal g times 2L. And let's bring this 2 up to this side. Lowercase m, capital M, v divided by 2 equals 4GL. And now I'm going to take the square root. So I've got lowercase m, capital M, v divided by 2. Square root of 4 is 2. And I have the square root of GL. So final answer, the velocity that I need for the muzzle velocity of the gun in order to make this all work has to be 4 capital M divided by lowercase m, the square root of GL. Okay, so we're starting to mix energy conservation and momentum conservation in solving our problems. So we have kind of a similar thing, I don't know, reversed and switched around in this problem here. So what we have is a compressed spring on a frictionless surface, and we're going to release that spring. And kind of no surprise, the spring pushes equally on either side, so we're going to have these objects going off at opposite velocities. There are no external forces here. The spring is an internal force, so the momentum of this guy is going to equal the momentum of that guy. And we have energy conservation, so we know that the initial spring potential energy is going to be converted to kinetic energy in the final state. So we're supposed to figure out then what the velocities are after the spring has been compressed. And in this case, they've given us numbers. Okay, so we've got momentum conservation. So it says that m1 v1 plus m2 v2 has to be 0. Right? So from the look of this thing, m1 is going to have a negative velocity and m2 is going to have a positive velocity. The initial momentum was 0, so the final momentum, total momentum, has to be 0. So we have to have that relationship. And we also have to have conservation of energy. So the initial energy is all stored in the spring because nothing is moving in the initial state. In the final state, both M1 and M2 are moving. But the spring is uncompressed. And the initial energy has to equal the final energy. So, I don't know, this should look good, but maybe a little bit scary to you. What we've got is two equations and two unknowns. It's made a little bit complicated because this is a quadratic equation, and quadratic equations are more difficult to solve than linear equations. So it would be nice if we could, you know, kind of simplify this so that there were fewer unknowns and we didn't actually have to use the quadratic equation. And I think one way of doing that may seem funny is just to create another unknown. So both M1 and M2 share the same momentum. One has a positive value of that momentum and one has a negative value of that momentum. So if I knew that momentum, I'd be all set to solving the problem. And it turns out with that substitution, in this bottom equation, I'm only going to have one variable. I'm only going to have P. Right? Because in general, the kinetic energy, which we know is 1/2 mv squared, if I multiply top and bottom by m, I can write that as p squared over 2m. So I can write this kinetic energy as 1/2 p squared divided by m1, and this kinetic energy is 1/2 p squared divided by m2. And that all nicely factors. Right? So this is going to give us 1/2, 1 over m1 plus 1 over m2, all times p squared. So I know the spring constant. I know how much it was compressed initially. I know these masses. I can calculate this shared value of the momentum. And once I've got that shared value of the momentum, I can go back and figure out what the velocities are. So there are other ways of solving it, but quadratics are always a little bit messier than linear equations. And we'll actually learn to solve this quadratic equation next time. Let's work out the numbers then. So what we have then is the initial energy is equal to the final energy. So let me erase this. So we've got 1 half k x squared is 1 half 1 over m1 plus 1 over m2 times p squareds. So the 1 halves go away. So I have k times x squared is 1 over m1 plus 1 over m2. That's all supposed to be p squared. So p, the shared value of momentum, is going to be the square root of k 1 over m1 plus 1 over m2 all times x. So k, we're told, is 280. M1 is 0.56 and the other one's 0.88. And the initial compression of the spring is 9.8 centimeters, which we're going to convert to meters. And then we can plug and chug to figure out what this common value of momentum is. And then to finally get the answer, we can go back to that guy. Oops, wrong big black box. Okay, so 1 over 0.56, 1 over 0.88, and then 280. Divide all those things, take the square root, and multiply by 0.98. And I get a momentum that is 0.959. And the units of momentum are, of course, mass times velocity, which is, of course, the same thing as a Newton second. So to figure out what V2 is, I need to take that momentum and divide it by the 0.88. And I get 109. And to get V2, I've got minus P divided by 0.56. I get, so which one should be moving faster? The lighter one, right? Because they have the same momentum, so more speed in the lighter one. And I get minus 1.71 meters per second. Okay, so conservation of energy is going to be kind of a forever thing. So we're going to combine it with conservation of momentum, particularly not in the next lab, but in the lab after that.